Station number 24730, Rail 6.
Mr. Boxall, Rail 6. We're talking about the time when you were in a camp near Gaza Airfield. Can you just describe to me, what your impressions were on rejoining the 9th? Because you'd been with them for a while before.
I joined them to start off with when I first went to Airborne Forces.
What were your impressions? I mean, were you pleased to get back to a regular battalion?
Well, yes, because I had some friends in the battalion. Also, I played hockey for the battalion. So that was all. That was, you know, quite decent. We did have not exciting bit, but we did have some Jews got onto the airfield and put bombs on the wing roots of some of the aircraft and blew them up.
Tell us about that. What do you remember of that?
Well, we of course weren't there, but we were a little way away. The next morning there were these you could see these aircraft with the broken wings and that, and then they decided that they would wire the compound in for the aircraft, and we had big bits of Bailey Bridge that carriers were attached to that pulled them in and out so that the aircraft could get in. And then once the aircraft were in, the gate was shut, and then we did patrols and guards around the outside of it, and the military police patrolled with their dogs.
So what were these patrols like? What do you remember? You know,
well, you sort of patrolled around the around the wire. Perhaps you do 2 hours patrol and then come in.
How many?
A section. Your section would do it.
Would you stay together or would you be spread out?
Well, no, you wouldn't be together, but you'd be far enough apart so that a burst of fire wouldn't knock all of you off. All this thing where you know, nowadays you see them all nearly holding hands. That's fateful. That's no good at all. You have to be well spaced apart so that a burst of fire doesn't kill you, or a mortar bomb dropping doesn't knock everybody off.
But you would be together. Oh like yeah, five yeah. Or 10 yards
oh yeah, 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 yeah.
And
you'd
then
be,
what would you do?
Well, you go round if you saw anyone suspicious. I mean, if you saw anyone trying to get in, you'd probably challenge them, and if you didn't get the answer you wanted, you'd fire at them. But we didn't. Once we'd got the wire in and got the aircraft inside the wire, there were no problems.
Would the patrols? I mean, they didn't have one man things, sentries around.
No. You'd patrol around, and the military police patrolled around with their guard dogs. I always used to carry a loaded pistol because I always swore that if they ever let one of their blooming guard dogs go at me, I'd kill the sodding thing. If you saw them, they were murderous blooming beasts.
How did you get on with the Arab civilians? Because they'd been the ones.
Well, they were as big a robbers as the blooming Jews. I mean, if they could, I've seen them run a donkey under a tent, cut the dog by a guy ropes, and disappear off down the Maidan with it. I mean, they'd steal the gold out of your teeth if they could.
So you didn't like either side?
Well, no. They were both of them. The Jews were... Well, they were trying to get us to leave Palestine. We were there doing a protectorate job. They didn't want us there. The Arabs didn't want the Jews there, and they didn't want us there, so... there wasn't much help from either of them.
And you had no sympathies for either?
Oh, no. I have no sympathy for them. I have no sympathy for them today, even. They talk about, you know, the Arabs blowing them up. The Jews did exactly the bloody same when we were there. They blew our people up. They put bombs on the side of the road. They blew up the David Hotel in Jerusalem. People say terrorism doesn't work. Well, you look at them. All the terrorists that there were and are, and what are they now? They're presidents of this country. They were presidents of somewhere else. The Jews most of them were terrorists to start off with. Terrorism does work. I mean, even Mandela, he's a well-respected person, but he was a terrorist. And there's no two ways of going about it. He was a and that's why they had him locked up. So, I mean, Jomo Kenyatta, he came out of the jungle, he was a terrorist, came out of the jungle, and what was he? He was president of the blooming country. So, no, I'm afraid my sympathies don't lie with any of them, really.
Now, so you'd rejoined, you know, do you know which company you were in? I should have asked earlier, I'm sorry about that.
Yes, I was with D Company to start off with.
And
D Company.
Your section stayed together in...
Well, I was a platoon sergeant then, so the platoon stayed together.
What would
together.
You say the job was? Of what your
well,
role
I wasn't there very long as a platoon sergeant because I was then promoted colour sergeant of D Company.
Well, do you mind just tell... What do you think a good platoon sergeant should be like? Or what was their role?
Well, a good platoon sergeant is a man who looks after his troops. A good sergeant, a good commander, his first thought is for his troops. Like nowadays, a good manager, his first thought is to look after his subordinates.
Now, in what way would the platoon sergeant look after his men?
Well, make sure that they were, you know, that their equipment was in good order. Make sure that they were clean. Make sure that they washed and shaved. Make sure that they looked after their kit. Make sure that they went and had the proper meals and look after them. Make sure that they looked after themselves. Because some of them will look after themselves, and some of them couldn't look after a blooming baby, let alone themselves. So you had to make sure that a good platoon sergeant, as I say, is like a good manager nowadays. You look after your subordinates.
And how did you relate with your officers? Because it's a funny thing, platoon sergeants often are an experienced soldier.
Oh, yeah.
And the person they deal with is an inexperienced second lieutenant.
Well, I always found that most of the officers I knew would listen to me. Major Chapman, if you ever speak to him, will probably tell you that I was a pain in the backside at times, but whenever if I offered advice, that was always good advice, and he always listened to what I said. So,
Who was your first one?
He was my company commander in Korea.
We'll
talk about that.
But generally, did you try and get on with your officers?
Oh, yes. Well, you had to. I mean, that was no good being at odds with them. Most of the officers I knew were, you know, quite decent people.
Did you ever get any who wouldn't listen to you at that stage?
Well, you got the odd one or two, but you try and make sure that what they do, they don't upset things too much.
Could you tell us, before we go on, were you doing running curfew patrols while you were there, before you became CQMS?
No, I became, a little while after we were there, I was made colour sergeant of the company, and then we did put a curfew on in Tel Aviv.
Well, tell us about that then.
We were some miles away from Tel Aviv, about 20 miles out away from Tel Aviv, and the colour sergeant's job was to feed the company. So the company stood to first light, and then you had to be there with a cup of tea and breakfast for them after they stood down. And then once you'd issued out breakfast and got them all sorted out, you then came back 20 or 30 odd miles back to the camp where all the utensils were handed in, and you got perhaps an hour's nap, and then you were back on the road again with lunch. And so once again out there, and of course all this time, there was always a chance that you were going to get hit by a bomb or someone was going to fire at you as you went along the road. So it wasn't a picnic by any means. We went, that would go out then for lunch, take lunch out, come back, another hour or so, out you go with tea, and then back again, and then back out again with last light cup of tea for them, and then you come back and it'd probably be about 9:30, 10 o'clock time you got back.
What staff would you have?
Just me and the company storeman.
But I mean, who? Where would you get all this food from?
The battalion cooks would do all that. That was all done by the battalion in the battalion cookhouse.
So what would you actually do? Pick it up and
actually pick it up in containers. You'd have to let your the quartermaster or colour sergeants know, or the cook sergeant know the numbers you were catering for, and then they would put it all in dixies and hay boxes, and you'd take it out and issue it out, come back in, give them the kit back in, and go and have a rest for half an hour, and then go back, start loading up for take out the next lot, and that's how you went on.
There'd be nobody, you didn't have an armed guard?
No, you had to look after yourself. You got blown up, that was your room before.
You weren't attacked or anything? No, you were lucky. Now, what were the actual curfew enforcement operations going on in Tel Aviv? I mean, I know you weren't in them, but what were they doing?
They were, once they put the curfew on, people were, they weren't allowed out of their houses. They weren't allowed go shopping or anything like that. They were confined to their houses all the while, and they wouldn't allow them out. And they put these curfews on occasions, perhaps a couple of nights. I think Tel Aviv the first time, it was a week when they put the curfew on.
Do you think they were effective?
They were effective in the fact that they stopped them using the carrying on their normal life, but it didn't stop them planting bombs or anything like that.
Now, one thing we haven't mentioned is the sergeant's mess. I should have asked. Yeah. Can you describe the sergeant's mess?
Well, it was we had a bar and a dining room, and we all had the sergeant's lines, tents, and that were all separate from the other ranks, and we had our own little cookhouse attached to the sergeant's mess with a couple of cooks who cooked for us. Our own bar and everything, you know.
What did it offer for you? I mean, was it slightly better food?
Yes, because, I mean, they were cooking for perhaps 40 or 50, whereas in the battalion they were cooking for hundreds. So, obviously, and at one time the cook sergeant ran was training cooks and ran a cook's course in the sergeant's mess, so the food was, you know, sort of really good.
And the bar, I mean, was there much drinking? Was it a hard drinking bar?
Oh, yes, yeah, a lot of them could put away a few drinks.
Were you a heavy drinker at the time?
No. I only drank socially. I probably drank brandy. I usually drank brandy, lime and lemon, and perhaps have two or three in an evening, but I never did drink.
Any reason why not?
Well, yeah, I thought it was a waste of blooming money. I thought, you know, I always did look on it, you might just as well go and put your money down the toilet, because that's where it ends up in the end.
Did you disapprove of some of...
I disapprove of people drinking to excess, because I don't think it does any good. It doesn't seem to me to help. If you're in trouble or, you know, like if you've lost someone, it doesn't help at all, in my opinion, to go drinking, because it doesn't do anything for you. It didn't do anything for me anyway.
Another point, your other recreation was things like hockey.
Yeah, well, hockey was the passion of my life, really. I learnt to play in India before the war, and of course, when I went to the 9th Power Battalion, originally I played for the battalion, and then when I went back again in Palestine, the hockey officer knew me, and he wrote me back into the team, and I played for them. I played for 6th Airborne Division, and we played people like the Palestine Police and those sort of teams. When I came home, I played for all the shot services. I played for the Depot Airborne Forces. When we were in Germany, I played for British Troops Berlin, for the 2nd Infantry Division, for 3 Infantry Brigade. And I used to play, played at least once a week during the hockey season.
You were really good then.
I could play, yeah. And sometimes, I mean, on one occasion I played three games in 2 days. Played in the morning, played in the afternoon, and played the following day.
Must have kept you pretty fit.
Oh, yeah. Well, my weight then was about 10 stone 7, and I kept that weight all the way through my service.
And did you play football? Or was
I played football a bit, not too much, and I played cricket a bit, but as I say, most of it was hockey. That was my game.
Now, any other recreations while you were in Gazareth?
Well, we used to go down to the beach swimming. And,
tell us about that.
Well, when you could, you'd perhaps the company would have a day out down at the beach, and you'd go down, and the company cook, you get a cook come with you, and they'd take a fire down, or build a fire, and brew up for you, and you go swimming. And then, of course, when we moved from...
Can I just, before you moved,
yeah.
Were you aware that... I mean, Gaza, there have been three battles there in the First World War. Were you aware of that at
no.
all?
No. No, I didn't.
Another thing is, what other jobs did the CQMS, the colour sergeant, have? I mean, you mentioned the provision of the unit. Yeah. What would you say the rest of your job was as CQMS?
Well, you had to make sure everybody's equipment was up to scratch, that if they were short of anything, that was got for them and issued out to them. And
how did you go about that?
Well, they had kit inspections, and they had a list of what you had to have. And once it was checked, if they were something short, say their boots were worn out, or their boots needed studding, or their boots needed resoling, their platoon sergeant would get them, bring them into the stores. You'd then have to label them, get them to the cobbler to repair or restud. Go to the QM stores to get new stuff if that was required, to replace stuff. And you generally looked after the admin of the company. So.
Did you enjoy the role, or did you prefer...
Yeah, I wasn't colour sergeant very long, because then I was made, in March 46, I was made company sergeant major and posted to C Company.
Is that when you moved... was that before you left
Gaza? That was before we left Gaza, yeah.
Now, that's quite quick promotion. Were people sent home by then?
Yeah. Yeah, I was only 23, I think. Was I 23? 1946, 24.
And this was of D Company still?
Yeah, no, I was promoted to Company Sergeant Major of C Company. And,
Can you just run through us? I know you probably think everyone knows, but they don't. You know, what exactly a Company Sergeant Major did? What was his responsibilities?
Well, he's responsible for the company as far as discipline is concerned, and the day-to-day running of the company. Now, he has to make out a detail for the company for the day. So, and he has to detail off, if it's your company's due to company, then you've got to detail off people do different fatigues, different jobs, different guards and things like that. And he looks after the discipline and drill of the company.
How do you look at, how exactly do you make your company... well disciplined and well drilled. How do you go about it?
I think a lot of it is the way you behave yourself. And now, if you sort of appear on parade three sheets to the wind, and it's not a very good. I always reckon it lead by example. And a good company sergeant major knows exactly what's going on in his company. He knows what is happening. And he makes sure that people do the jobs that they're supposed to do. And as I've always said, a good NCO or warrant officer is like a good manager nowadays. Your sole purpose is to look after the people under you. Not look after yourself, but look after the people under you. And I always apply that, even when I came out into the civil life.
Who was the major in command of C Company? Do you remember? Or
I think I had a Major Norbury.
Norbury. How did you get on with him?
Oh, all right. He was. I got on with most officers quite well. not many did. I had one or two.
But nothing special about Norbury.
Well, no.
And what state was the union? Were people sort of sweating on D-Mob?
Well, there were a lot, because they were going home quite, because they were then, they had their D-Mob numbers. I mean, mine was 29 deferred regular. I would have been out of my ear hole if it hadn't been that I was a deferred regular. And as I say, once...
Were people getting restive or at all?
Well, they had little charts up with how many days they'd got to go and things like that. It was, I suppose, the end of the war. People were looking forward to going back into Civvy Street and not having Sergeant Major shouting at them and sergeants. It was a state of flux, really. And of course, they were cutting the armed forces down as well. So
how long were you at Gaza for? Or did anything else happen while you were there?
We then moved. Don't know when, but we moved up to Haifa, and we were in Peninsula Barracks, Haifa.
Which barracks?
Peninsula Barracks, Haifa. And from there, we used to do roadblocks and curfews. I mean, one of the things that I had was we had a white scout car and a three-tonner with a bring gun in the front of the white scout car and a bring gun in the back of the three-tonner, and we were allowed to stop any vehicle and check it. And our favourite thing was in the main road in Hadar Carmel in Haifa, stop a big fruit lorry and make them unload it right in the middle of the road. Knowing full well you wouldn't get anything, but knowing full well that was one of the things you could do to upset people. And so we used to home in on a lorry loaded with fruit or vegetables, make them unload it in the middle of the road, and then when they got it all unloaded, knowing full well you weren't going to find any, say, right on, mate, you can go now. And we'd dive off. It was the same with... We had a...
Any of the roadblocks, what were you meant to be looking for?
Well, the roadblocks were to make sure that no terrorists or anyone with bombs or anything got through. But we had a roadblock that we used to put on outside of Haifa, north of Haifa, and we had a sheaf of papers which said every vehicle that was allowed through, the registered number of it, the number of passengers, and what time it was allowed in and what time it was allowed out. And if it came through at the wrong time or a bus came in that wasn't on the list, you didn't let it go through. I mean, it didn't matter where it was going. I mean, I've had them come through about half past 11 at night with a bus that was a wrong bus and send it away, and the passengers have been there and they said, well, they were going up the Coast Road miles, and I said, well, you better start walking then because you ain't going to have the bus. That was the only way we had of getting back at them. I know perhaps it was a bit petty.
Was this Jewish people? Mostly.
Well, there was, one or two. There was a sprinkling of Americans that came over that were there that sort of thought they should have been treated different, but we didn't treat them any different than anyone else.
And what about patrolling around Haifa?
We didn't do it. Roving patrols that we did with a couple of trucks, and we were allowed to stop any vehicle or anything, but we didn't do much foot patrolling. We did do once they put curfews on, they did patrols, but as I said, you know, you walk along the street and someone would lean over the balcony and spit at you or something, so we weren't greatly admired. Not that we deserved it, I think, at times.
What do you mean by that?
Well, some of our people could be a bit brutal, to say the least.
In what way? Who?
Well, I mean, I had a little sergeant. We were on a curfew in Hadar Carmel one day, and he came in and he said to the company commander, the Greek Archbishop outside wants to talk to you, sir. And the company commander said, I don't want to talk to him, kick him out. And this little sergeant walked out, turned his bishop round and kicked him. And so, you know, there was a bit of a stink about that, but as he said, you know, the company commander said, kick him out. I did. Perhaps it was the wrong term to use, but then, as I say, you know, we were treated the same, so we never had much sympathy for them. I never did. I don't now.
Any other sort of internal security duties you had?
No, that was it. That was, you know, these roadblocks that we did, plus the roving patrols. But of course, it was always, I mean.
We haven't talked much about the roving. Let's talk about the roving patrols a bit. What exactly would happen on a typical roving?
Well, you'd go along and you could stop any vehicle and search it. And that was about it. But, I mean, when illegal immigrant boats came in, for instance, came into Haifa Harbour, they'd pull them, bring them in, and then someone would have to fight to get them off the boat, get them onto another boat to send them back to Cyprus, because they had a detainee camp in Cyprus that they used to send them all to. And, I mean, that was a job on its own.
Well, tell us about that, then.
Well, I mean, they used to come in these illegal immigrant boats, packed in like blooming sardines. The Navy used to probably arrest them out to sea and bring them into Haifa. And then they'd have to be... All the people who were on the illegal immigrant boat, they'd have to be got off and got back onto another ship that took them out back to Cyprus to the camp. And then they were vetted there, I believe, and eventually allowed to come in. But they didn't come in automatically. And
were you in what stage would you be involved?
Well, we weren't involved in that. I was never involved in actually with the...
You weren't down on doing the...
No,
not actually,
no. No.
What else were you doing there? What about the barracks? Can you describe...
The barracks were a huddled camp. Were huts.
What were the huts like?
They were just wooden huts. At the end of each barrack hut, there was a room, or a couple of rooms, sealed off that warrant officers or sergeants used. There was a sergeant's mess and an officer's mess and things like that. And it was sort of very much like a hutted camp here in England.